I told my husband you were coming in today so you can help solve a dispute.
Oh, okay.
And
he
can make peace in my household.
Yes.
Because we have this running debate about Social Security and when to take it. Is it best, if you can, to wait as long as you can?
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein.
Thanks so much for tuning in.
First, to Regular Guys from Maryland and their amazing mission to bring water to rural African communities.
Then, advice from a pro for your finances after 50.
Next, looking to get back into the dating game? This just might be your nudge.
Plus, the silent epidemic of hepatitis C, another public health concern for boomers.
And we'll shoot the breeze about why craftsmanship matters. Water is something that many of us take for granted. It's pretty much a given that if you turn on the spigot, water will flow, unless you are one of the 780 million people worldwide who do not have access to clean water, according to the World Health Organization, and nearly 2.5 billion lack adequate sanitation. On top of that, another 6 to 8 million people die annually as a result of water-related diseases.
For the past 8 years, one Maryland businessman has made it his mission to bring water to rural African communities, where more than 300 million people reside in water-scarce communities. Ken Wood is a professional well driller who, with a very small crew of volunteers, has drilled 1,175 wells, bringing water to over 500,000 residents of Ghana and Tanzania, dramatically changing their lives for the better. Ken and one of his dedicated volunteers, Jim Stark, join us in our studios. Welcome, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. Ken, tell us briefly how you first began your well drilling mission.
We had a well drilling rig for sale and a mission from York, Pennsylvania, Aldergate Methodist Church. I wanted to buy a rig and send it to Ghana. They had heard of the guinea worm problem, and they had a mission trip with doctors and things, and they wanted to add this to their projects. So they approached us and asked us if we would paint the rig and bring it up to show the people what they were saving their money for, and which I did. And when I took it to them, they asked if I would go to Ghana. And at that time, we were so busy, and I had no thoughts or no knowledge of the problem of water anywhere except where we were. And I thought I had to rush and work 12 hours a day and keep things going at home. But anyway, 2 weeks later, I'm on a bank board and we go to a seminar in Kiowa Islands, I think it was. And the key speaker comes out and says, "My name is Albert. I'm from Ghana." And that scared the devil out of me right there. But furthermore, his speech was on having to walk 2 miles twice every morning to get water out of a scum pond, such as the pictures I've shown you.
So why did that scare you when you first saw the gentleman at the talk?
Nothing is a coincidence. When God calls, pick up the phone. So if that isn't somebody talking to you, I don't know what is. So I decided before I told my wife, I'm going to Ghana, not knowing what we were in for. And once I got there and saw the devastation, then you can't stop. You have a little bit of a talent, along with many people that got me there and many people that helped. It's not one person. It's many, 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 many people.
And what was the initial reaction of the Ghanaian people when you really first brought water to their village the very first time?
It's no feeling like it. It just, people are going to live from something you're doing and be healthier, not be sick all the time. People get parasites like Bilharzio. I can't pronounce it exactly right, but something like that, and many other parasites, and they're sick all the time. The guinea worm, they do not have the resources for the medication to get rid of this stuff, so they're sick a long time. So when you have a talent that can help that many people, there's no price tag for that.
Well, Ken, we understand that you recently returned from a well-digging trip where you brought water to a village of about 25,000 people. Can you describe, was that in Ghana as well?
Yes. They had two drilled wells that they had one hand pump working for 25,000 people. They made the school kids get the water from the river, and most of the town did because the lines were so long getting the water out of a simple hand pump. You can't imagine the
one single hand pump for 25,000 people.
The lines were just, it was so bad. And at that time, I did not have the money to do what I said I was going to do, but it came.
And Ken, how far do these people have to walk from the hand pump to their house typically, or to the school?
In that town, it wasn't so bad, half a mile at the most, you know, but most of them went to the river, which is a mile or two away, and the school kids had a couple mile walk, all had to bring a bucket of water every day and put it in a tank, which was muddy. So we bought 2 miles of pipe, spigots, two 2,000 gallon tanks. When they finally got it going in April, things worked very slow in Africa. You have to threaten them to get them to move a little bit, but they got it going. They said the ladies were singing in the streets and dancing in the streets, you know, because it's just very, very important. You know.
Yeah, and life is a lot easier.
Oh, goodness. And now they can do things more worthwhile than sitting waiting for water or walking for water or whatever.
Now, in this village that you just came from, did they have electricity?
They did.
They did.
They did.
So, Ken, describe the architecture of the houses in the village.
Most of them are clay huts. This was North Ghana, and they have round ones. I hadn't seen that before, but they make them round for some reason. They're mostly clay, made out of clay, have grass roofs.
Now, Jim, Ken has told us that you're the memory maker on these trips, that you capture the experience through your camera lens. Can you tell us about your own living accommodations while you're on a well-drilling mission? I mean, we're venturing to guess they're not exactly five-star accommodations.
No, but not by far. Sometimes I do the dumbest things while I'm over there, but nevertheless, the accommodations are terrible. Sometimes they're better than others. You're very lucky if you have air conditioning, and more lucky if you have hot water. Okay. The food is something to be desired. You get used to it, but I don't care for it too
much.
Well,
a little birdie said when you brought up the food that at one point you actually ate one thing for 21 days in a row. What was that?
I was eating spaghetti. They had rice, but I didn't care for it. And then they had fish, and they brought the fish out, and you could see his eyes and everything, and that just turned me off. So the only thing I ate was spaghetti, and I did that for 21 straight days.
And was that spaghetti with sauce or just spaghetti?
Yeah, they had sauce.
Oh,
yeah,
there you go.
That doesn't
sauce.
Sound so bad.
Yeah, no.
21 days? I don't know. Now, Jim, you just mentioned that you do some of the dumbest things while you're in Africa. Can you give us an example?
Well, at one time, we had a Rotarian that was there with us, and he wanted me to take him back to the hotel to attend a meeting, an international meeting. So I took him back, and I thought to myself, well, I don't want to stay in the hotel all afternoon. So I decided I'd go back to the job site. So I got in the truck, and I went back, and lo and behold, I got lost. I said, God, I don't really know where I'm at. And I crossed this one road, and when I got on top of the road, here comes this man with a AK-47 pointing at me.
Ooh.
And, I mean, needless to say, I was very, very scared. And he was pointing to the ground, so I didn't know exactly what he meant. But then after a while, I thought, hey, I crossed the border. And I was thinking, well, he hadn't shot me yet, so he had called, I guess, his boss or something. They came up in a motorcycle, and another guy had an AK-47. And there was a guardian angel there. It was alongside the road. It was a guy from Ghana. And he explained to this guy that we were drilling wells. So they let me go. So when he got in the truck, I said to him, jolt, which means go. And he took me back to the job site. And I opened my wallet, and I had, I don't know, maybe $100 worth of CDs, the money that they have. So I gave him all the money I had. And I told him, I said, I'd give you my credit card if I thought it'd do any good.
You were so grateful. You
oh,
really
God,
saw
saved my life.
Your life flash
yeah,
before
my
your
life.
Eyes.
But by saying you're a well digger, I bet that goes far there.
Yes, very much so.
Could be the magic words.
Yeah.
Our guests are Ken Wood and Jim Stark, volunteer well diggers who in the last 8 years have brought water to more than 500,000 residents of Ghana and Tanzania. I'm Barbara Klein, and my co-host is Kathy Bernard. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or at iHeartRadio.com. Now back to our conversation with Ken Woods and Jim Stark about their ongoing mission to bring water to the people of Ghana and Tanzania. Well, Ken, let me ask you, how many trips have you made so far?
33.
Wow. And how long do your trips generally last?
We normally set it up for 21, 22 days
wow.
at a time.
So. Okay. And how many volunteers do you take with you typically?
Typically one or two. the last trip I went by myself, but I've got a pretty good crew down there now.
Does it ever become a family affair?
Oh, yes, it sure does. I'm hoping someday to get all my grandchildren down there so they can be humbled like I am. So,
well, give us an idea of how much it costs to drill one well.
It varies. In the sand country, we can sometimes get away with $2,000, $2,500. In the rock country, it's $35,000 to $4,000 to drill a well in the rock. You burn 100 gallons of fuel a day, and it's over $6 a gallon, and then your equipment cost and all that. So,
and that doesn't include your transportation back and forth to Africa, does it?
We don't even count that. Everybody that goes pays their own way.
And Ken, you recently had a very challenging task of bringing water to what you coined the Lost Village. Why was that so difficult?
It was difficult just getting to the people through many, many trees and underbrush to get out 3 miles out to them. And I kept telling the guy, we're not going because it's going to kill my tires. And I thought he was sort of a politician running for some kind of committee or something and thinking he wasn't straight. So I kept putting him off until this Saturday night we finished and they had cut a path for us. And they took me out on a motorcycle and I found plenty of stubs where the tires would get broken, you know, blow the tires on the where they cut the trees. But so I showed them all the stubs, and Sunday morning we go out and very carefully stopping on the way to cut more of those stubs off because they stick up like a sharp knife or something, and they will get the tires. So anyway, we got there, and on a Sunday morning, got the well drilled. The people were walking 3 miles to get water out of a pond after the cows go in early in the morning.
Well, 3 miles one way to get water.
Yes. So we got the well in. It turned out to be a very good well, and we were all celebrating. And they brought out their typical gift to you. It could be anywhere from what I had the last time, two cassava plants is like two sweet potatoes maybe, and a goat.
Oh, and a so, live goat, huh?
Yes. In that area, the typical gift is a goat. They come out and cut the throat in front of you, give you the head and the intestines to take with you, which my driver enjoyed taking home. Then they cook it right on the spot for you.
For a celebration.
But anyway, this the guy in the village had a goat and a knife in his right hand after I finished that morning, and I talked him into telling him that all I wanted was the picture, you know, so that goat got to live another time.
Oh, good.
So it's very difficult not to take what they offer you because it's bad manners, but I got away with that one. So
now, Jim, we hear you also help bring water to a nomadic group called the Maasai. Can you tell us a little bit about them and what their issue was with the water?
Oh, they're my favorite people. They're very intimidating. They wear a lot of jewelry. They pierce their bodies. They're very tall. When you first look at them, you think, oh, my God, you get scared because they carry a club. And believe it or not, they have cell phones. If you've ever seen a guy with a club,
oh,
a sword,
God, and a cell
and a
phone.
Cell phone. But they're very nice. I love the kids. Their pecking order is a little different than ours. The men dominate. The kids may come next, and the women are low on a totem pole. The women do all the work. They fetch the water. They do the cooking. They take care of the kids. But the language that they speak is Swahili. Some of them know a little bit English, few words, but they're nomads. The cattle is their main source of livelihood. And they tell me that these nomads, they can go out with, if they have no water, they will slit one of the veins of one of their cattle and draw their blood and drink
and
their
drink
blood.
It. Jim, can you describe real quickly about how the cows and the kids are bathing in the same water?
They do that.
Yeah.
They do. You'll find like a pond. The nomads, they'll drive their cattle there to feed them. In the meantime, the mothers and the kids are taking baths in there and they're getting water.
And that's not too healthy.
They share it.
Yeah.
I tell this a lot of time. You and I could not drink their water because our immune system would not handle it. Their immune system is probably a lot different than ours. We don't drink any of their water. We all have bottled water. But some of their immune system has adapted to these germs that may be in this water. And a lot of them, they just don't adapt, and they get sick and perish.
Well, Ken, finally and very quickly, you have been honored by the Ghanaian people. And in fact, you were given an official title. Can you tell us about that?
My name is Tugby Abechi. which means cheap living water.
Well, very fitting.
So, isn't that wonderful?
So I told them that they could not make me work any harder than I was working if they were trying to do so by doing this honor, but it was kind of cool at the time.
Ken, you have a very creative way of raising money to help finance the wells, which have come out of actually a hobby. Can you tell us about it?
In the beginning, for the second trip, I sold my 57 T-Bird and sold some building lots, and Ben sold his boat for the first trip. And after that, the horses started doing better and better. And
so the horses, tell us about the horses.
Yeah, we're in the racehorse business, and we got by and make a few dollars, but they started doing better. And the drilling business was good at the time. A lot of the money came from the drilling also, but it is kind of crazy, some of the things that have happened that, like you say, are not coincidence. There's somebody else helping.
But a lot of this is self-financed just by the volunteers and by you.
It was in the beginning, all of it, yes. Yeah. And now we have Rotary clubs and Lions clubs and churches.
You even have an Adopt-A-Well program, is that correct?
Yes, we do. With just the cost of the supplies and things. And we'll tag a well for someone, and people like to do that.
And Ken, if people wanted to find out more about their program, where would they go?
Just wellsforghana.com. We'll get you there.
Well, Ken Woods and Jim Stark, two men on a mission to bring as much water as possible to the people of Ghana and Tanzania, you two are really inspiring. And it's been an honor having you join us here in our studio. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And
we've
never had a chief in our studio before.
No.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The world of finances is more complex than ever. Most of us hope that after working for what seems to be a lifetime, that we'll have accumulated enough to live comfortably until we take our last breath. We have a lot of questions and decisions to make, some of which just might keep us up at night.
As Senior Vice President at Charles Schwab, Carrie Schwab Pomerantz has spent the past 30 years serving clients and advocating for investors. She's also the author of the Charles Schwab Guide to Finances After 50, and she joins us in our studio to offer some of her best financial tips. Welcome to the show, Carrie.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Carrie, there's so many people out there that have really taken a beating with the downturn of the economy over the past few years. Some have lost jobs. Others might be sort of eating away at their savings and retirement. So for those who basically have to start over in midlife, where do they even begin?
That is such a tough question. And to be honest with you, there is no silver bullet. And that's why I would say we need financial literacy in this country earlier so that people are better prepared and don't get themselves in these conundrums, that they have some padding in their lives. I think what we need to do is give these people not only hope, make sure that they're not embarrassed and that they have sort of the dedication to put on their bootstraps and move forward with a plan and really assess where are they and where do they need to go. And if they need help, I think they should absolutely get help. Like the AARP Foundation has Finances After 50. And we have seen through this program, we're in partnership with Charles Schwab, that people not only going through a workshop, but they're also being mentored by a money mentor. And we're seeing that we're reducing anxiety. People are spending less and saving more and actually shopping for fees, which also can get, dip into whatever money you might have at that point.
Okay.
So I would say get help. And there's a lot of benefits out there, like even the earned income tax credit. I bet a lot of people are entitled to that, but don't realize that they are.
Right. Okay. So it is possible to recover even at midlife.
I actually have a chapter in the book. I'm 50 and I haven't started. Is it too late?
Mm-hmm.
And, whether you were affected by the Great Recession or not, I have to tell you that there are a lot of 50 plus year olds who have not started. And that's because they figure I'll get old later. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And they want the good life. And obviously some people have been hit hard, but don't lose hope. And let me just give you a financial example that, given you probably have 15 to 20 years potentially to work, hopefully, your health will stay in check. If you have a 401k with a catch-up contributions, an individual who's 50 years old is entitled to save $23,000 a year in their 401k. Now, I realize that's a lot of money. But if you can afford to do so, the $23,000 after 15 years at a 6% rate of return can grow to $570,000. And I realize that not everybody can save $23,000, but it just shows you the power of compound growth. And 15 years can make a big difference. And you really have to think of savings as non-negotiable. You just got to be disciplined, put your nose to the ground, and make savings automatic.
Carrie, you mentioned the catch-up rules. What are they?
The IRS realizes that 50-plus-year-olds need to start saving more and put it on turbo. So they have allowed those of us who turn 50 to save an additional $5,500 in our 401k and get the tax deferral from that extra $5,500. Now, in your IRA, you can save an additional $1,000, again, available to anybody who's 50 and over.
Well, Carrie, say we're lucky and retirement is actually in our future, you know, maybe 5 years out. How should we be investing besides the 401k? If we have some money, should we be taking a more conservative approach the closer we get to retirement, or should we just like buy those Japanese bonds somewhere?
I'm a big believer in diversification and investing in equities. And in fact, we do have a chapter in the book about this because there used to be this misconception that I am retiring and therefore I've got to put everything in CDs and bonds. But what people don't realize is that it's almost riskier to put all your money in cash products because interest rates are so low. And this has been historical. This is not just because of today's interest rates, but inflation is a killer. Let me give you an example. If you have an inflation rate of 3%, which is high for today, but it's considered low historically, $100,000 today, in 20 years, that $100,000 would have the same purchasing power as $55,000. So you see that your money is being eroded by inflation. So you need equities, at least 20% of your portfolio in a diversified portfolio of equities. And if you can overcome the feelings of risk, you should probably put more than 20%.
And what about if we hear about this great new company that's very avant-garde and we're, you know, approaching retirement age? Should we go for it or should we really try to be more conservative in our approach?
I like the core and explorer approach. You know, you really need to have what I call a diversified portfolio. You know, you need to have at least 20% in stock, maybe 40%. When I say stock, I mean in international, small cap, large cap, domestic, and so forth. And then you need to have the other portion in mostly in bonds, again, diversified, muni bonds, corporate bonds, treasuries, and then a small sliver in cash. If you have the majority of your money diversified like that, you can ride the waves over time. If you're interested in that hot stock, fine, but know that it's a big risk. Don't put all your assets in that. Just take a little portion and have some fun, and that's fine, but have the core in a diversified portfolio.
Kind of to switch gears a little bit, long-term health care insurance is a real head shaker. It's extremely expensive, but then the cost of long-term care is frightening, to say the least. So what is your best advice? What policies should we look for? When should we look to be purchasing these policies, if you suggest that? Where do we go?
Long-term care is fairly new, and I think we're still trying to learn it. But you're right. The majority of us will have to get some type of skilled care later in our life. Another misconception is that Medicare will cover it, and it will not. Mm-hmm. It will only cover skilled nursing care. So, you know, some people have the assets where they can self-insure, but could be, depending on where you live, $100,000 a year to $200,000 a year. And if that's something you don't think you can afford, a policy could be the right choice. And it's a little tricky on when to actually buy it. We usually say anywhere from age 54 to 62. You don't want to wait too late, and you don't want to try to purchase it when you're ill. So again, I think somewhere in that range, the younger you are, the policy will be cheaper, but you also have to look at what it covers. You know, will it cover pre-existing conditions? Will it have a inflation kicker? So you really need to compare, see what they cover and what and compare the cost.
And how do you even know this company is going to exist 20, 30, hopefully 40 years when we actually have to
And that's the big question.
The policy?
I mean, that's a very good question. I think you have to really check out the underlying insurance company. You know, has it been around for a long time? There are actually third-party ratings of insurance companies. So take a look at that and their history of payouts and so forth. But again, it's not a perfect situation.
Yeah. Well, finally, Carrie, I told my husband you were coming in today so you can help solve a dispute.
Oh, okay.
And he can make peace in my household.
Yes.
Because we have this running debate about Social Security and when to take it. Is it best, if you can, to wait as long as you can to take those benefits from Social Security, or should you take it when you're 62?
Yeah, 75% of 62-year-olds last year took Social Security. Now, admittedly so, we've had a tough time in this country, but I can't imagine that 75% of 62-year-olds really needed to take it out. And, you know, I have a Schwab client who, you know, is obviously doing okay, and he said he was worried that Social Security would go away, so he took it out. And there's good reasons at 62 if you're out of a job, of ill health. But you are leaving money on the table. If you, you know, have longevity in your family, you're doing well, you want to at least consider taking it out at full retirement age, which depending on when we were born, probably 66, 67 years old. If you wait until then, your benefit will be up 25%. Now, if you wait till you're 70, it'll be 76% more than had you take it out at 62. So you can't get that kind of rate of return anywhere, especially with these low interest rates. And what people don't realize is every year you wait between 62 and 70, there's a chart, and it goes up from anywhere from 6.5% to, I think, a little over 8%. And, you know, it behooves you to consider, you know, you don't have to wait to full retirement age, but wait a few years at least to get that better benefit.
Right, and just hope you live long enough.
I hope you live.
Take good care of yourself and take those benefits later.
Well, we all are living longer. I mean, that, you know, so that's a fact. So you have to kind of, again, take a look at your family history and how fit you are as well.
Well, I wish we had more time. So many more questions. Carrie Schwab Pomeranz, financial expert and author of The Charles Schwab Guide to Finances After 50. Thanks so much for your great advice.
Thank you for having me.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. Up next, looking to get back in the dating game? You won't want to miss our next guest. Stay with us.
Online dating industry leader eHarmony reports that those ages 50 and older are one of the fastest growing segments among its more than 33 million users. Similar trends have surfaced at the popular Match.com, where about 25% of its members are between 50 and 65. That's a whole lot of midlifers out there looking for love.
But sometimes it takes a little nudge to jump into the online dating game. There's one perfect photo, then creating an online profile, and figuring out how to initiate contact with a potential date. Erica Etten, owner of A Little Nudge in Washington, D.C., helps coach people through all these hurdles of online dating. She joins us in our studios to share some tips. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you for having me.
So who are your clients?
Well, my clients are all kinds. So I've worked with people aged 22 to 72. And when people generally come to me, either they've tried online dating before and it hasn't worked for them for one reason or another. They're too busy to do online dating and they say to themselves, well, if I don't outsource this, I'm not going to do it. Or they've never done online dating before because they either were married for a long time, you know, or their husband or wife passed away. And this is, I mean, this is a new time for dating. I mean, everything is different than it used to be. So those are the three categories of people who come to me.
Are they looking for a spouse? Are they just looking maybe to share a bag of popcorn with at a movie?
All of the above. Buttered popcorn.
Buttered popcorn.
All of the above. So I always ask what people are looking for. And I will say most of my clients are looking for, whether it's a spouse or not, it doesn't really matter, but a long-term relationship of some sort. But some people, they're just happy to go on a date again after, you know, 20, 30 years. So it really runs the gamut. And that's why when people ask me what success is like, I don't define success as marriages because success is different for different people.
So let's walk through the steps of getting on a dating site. So first is the dreaded picture, the profile picture.
Uh-huh.
So how important is that?
How important do you think it is? It's very,
very
important.
Very important. How up to date does it have to be? That's the big question.
It has to be up to date. So I say, as a general rule of thumb, within the last year is pretty accurate, unless you've cut your hair, you've changed your appearance significantly, you've grown a full beard, whatever it is. But generally speaking, within the last year, you look pretty much the same.
And should you be alone, or should you be with another person? Because I would think if you're with another person, that they might be more attractive than you, and then they don't want you.
Yep, exactly. That actually very unfortunately happened to a client of mine once, a female client who posted a picture with her friends, and somebody asked her for her friend's number, and she was devastated, obviously. So for that reason alone, be by yourself. I recommend 3 to 5 pictures. Less is more when it comes to pictures. Some people go overboard and put 10, 20 pictures up there, which is, gosh, that's a Facebook album. That's not an online dating profile. So we just have to make sure someone can see your face, see what you look like, and then see your body, see what your body looks like. Because very unfortunately, and I think we all do this, people assume the worst. And if you're withholding information, meaning you only have headshots, people assume the worst about what you look like. So it's best to have 3 to 5 really good
full
pictures of yourself.
Body pictures?
I know.
Oh,
ooh.
That's scary. That's really scary.
Why? You both are so cute.
And in your bikini, Barbara.
Oh, of course. I'll just get out
the bikini,
that 40-year-old bikini.
The bathroom selfie is another one. Oh, my gosh. Please don't do that usually with dirty laundry in the background.
Oh.
It's like in the toilet. No, thank you.
And then should you be doing something exotic in this picture, like, parachute jumping or hand gliding?
Or riding an elephant?
Have you ridden an elephant? I'm so impressed.
Oh, I have.
I'm very impressed.
Liar, liar, pants
on
fire.
I have.
Yeah. I just call that the interesting picture. So it doesn't have to be an active picture necessarily, but it's a picture that generates conversation. So if you have a picture of yourself riding an elephant, somebody is going to ask, where were you? Was that hard? Do you do this often? Are you an elephant rider for a living? Whatever it is. So it's something to generate conversation. I used to have a picture of myself with a microphone singing, and I got questions. Where are you singing? Do you do that professionally? It's just people don't know what to write. So if you give them an in through that interesting picture, it just makes it easier.
Okay, well, what to write? That's a big question, too, the profile.
Yes.
It almost sounds like we're writing a resume about ourselves. Where do we even begin? It sounds daunting.
It is daunting. Even if you're a professional writer, it's hard when you have to write about yourself, because you have to run that fine line between you don't want to be too braggy, but you also want to make sure you're putting your best foot forward. So I would say get the word resume out of your head, because when people think resume, it's very dry. It's very, here are my accomplishments. Here is why you should want me. And we don't want to be that dry. We want to be approachable. So I would say, think to yourself, what are your best attributes? And you don't have to appeal to the masses. You don't have to say the things you think people want to hear. Hi, I love to laugh and have fun. I'm just as comfortable going out and staying in.
And walking in the sunset.
Yeah, taking long walks on the beach. None of that. Because that could, describe anyone. So I would say put your quirks at the forefront, right? So think of the things that make you, you, and write about those things.
Oh, boy, that'd be a little
scary.
So in other words, you got to really stand out from the crowd.
Exactly. Especially because you were saying before, online dating is growing. It's a growing market, especially for this age demographic. And the more people there are, the more you have to differentiate yourself.
To what extent do we kind of stretch the truth before it becomes like we're lying?
I would not stretch the truth, but there are ways to spin things in a positive light. For example, a client of mine loves, what did she say? She loves reading some gossipy magazine, and we wrote about it in a very cute manner. And she's like, wow, I always thought that was a weakness of mine, but people loved that line because you just spin it as, I have a guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
But what about responding to all those responses we're going to get from our fabulous online profile? So should you banter back and forth for a while before you make a date?
Yeah, I would say no more than 3 emails back and forth before you schedule a date, because ultimately, and I always say to meet sooner rather than later, because I call chemistry the wild card. You don't know if you're going to have it till you meet. So someone's persona over email could be totally different in person. They could be great over email and witty because they're sitting and thinking about it and not in person, or just emailing is not their thing. But when you meet them, they're extremely personable. So I would say meet sooner rather than later. Don't make a big thing of it. It's just going to be a coffee or a drink, cocktail, whatever it is, in and out. And that way, if you at least have some chemistry with that person.
And should the initiator of the date pick up the check, or should it just be split 50-50?
I would say neither of those. I encourage the gentleman to pay.
Oh, she's old-fashioned.
Like I guess it's funny. I always encourage both men and women to send emails. You know, if someone interests you, send that email. But for the sake of chivalry, I hope it doesn't completely die. So as a woman, I would always offer, you know, oh, may I contribute? But let's just hope he doesn't say yes.
And that's a test right there if they say, oh, sure, you pay for it.
It's not a test because everyone feels just like we had some differences of opinion. So everybody, you know, has differences of opinion on that. So, you know, sometimes a woman will insist. It really just depends. But I do encourage at least my male clients to pay.
Well, finally, I just have to ask you, have you had success by using your own words of wisdom
of
for
course.
Online dating?
Of course. I've been very successful at online dating. And like I said before, success is different for different people. So I've had short-term relationships, long-term relationships, and just, you know, more emails responded to than I thought I would. So, I've had much success at online dating, and more important to me is my client's success, right? So I've had a lot of clients meet someone, get married. It warms my heart every time I think about it.
Well, Erica Etten, owner of A Little Nudge in Washington, D.C., lots of great advice. Thanks so much for joining the
Thank
Two Boomer
Thank you for
Days.
Having me.
According to the C. Everett Koop Institute at Dartmouth Medical School, it's suspected that there are more than 4.5 million people in the United States that are infected with hepatitis C, and more than 200 million around the world, making it one of the greatest public health epidemics of our time. In fact, the death rate from hepatitis C now surpasses that from AIDS.
Joining us to talk about this major public health concern is Dr. Michael Epstein, a gastroenterologist at Anne Arundel Medical Center in Annapolis, Maryland. Welcome to the program, doctor.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Doctor, tell us about the Hep C virus. What is it?
The Hep C virus is an RNA virus that primarily affects the liver. It's been around for a long time. And it affects people primarily born between the ages of 1945 and 1965. It gets into the liver where it rapidly replicates and can cause chronic liver disease, leading to cirrhosis and hepatocellular cancer, along with other complications as well. It's also been associated with a number of other diseases and illnesses.
And how does it differ from the other types of hepatitis? A and B?
Well, that's a very good question, because for hepatitis A, most patients that get it when they're young, or they will recover completely. With hepatitis B, also, the majority of people that are infected with hepatitis B, unless they're infected in their very early age, tend to recover from hepatitis B. However, hepatitis C, more than 85% of patients that are exposed will develop chronic hepatitis. Many of the patients never know that they were exposed. They got this illness surreptitiously, and they're not aware that they're infected. That's become a very big health problem throughout the world and here in the United States as well.
So is that why it's often referred to as a silent epidemic?
Absolutely. Currently, we've only identified about 25% or less of those that are infected, so there's at least 2.5 to 3 million people out there who yet have to be tested. To that end, the CDC has recommended that we begin screening, which has not heretofore been done, but that we should start testing anyone born between the ages of 1945 and 1965. Anyone that's ever used injection drugs even once or gotten clotting factors before 1987 or has elevated liver tests, has ever gotten an organ transplant or blood transfusion before 1992, people with nasal cocaine use, history of multiple tattoos, body piercings, multiple sex partners, people that have been in a long-term steady relationship with someone with HCV, hepatitis C, that is, and children born to hepatitis C infected women. So there's a lot of opportunity for screening, and it needs to be done.
So when we're talking about transmission, are we talking about is hepatitis C transmitted through bodily fluids?
That's a very good question. There is some transmission, but it's very low. What we recommend is that if someone is known to have hepatitis C, that you avoid sharing toothbrushes or dental equipment, that you avoid using sharing shaving equipment, that you cover any bleeding wounds. It's mostly through blood. But if you are having sex, particularly with multiple partners, of course, also using a barrier method is important as well. But in normal everyday household contact, the risk of transmission of hepatitis C is exceedingly low. In one study in spouses that were married for more than 10 years to a partner that had hepatitis C, the risk of transmission was less than 1 in 10.
Well, let me ask you about drinking out of even the same glass. Is that a way that it could be transmitted through the saliva?
No. Common everyday contact, kissing, you know, hugging, using common utensils has never been shown to be a method for hepatitis C transmission.
Doctor, what are the symptoms someone should look for?
Well, that's a really good question. The majority of patients that we see don't have any symptoms from hepatitis C, or they might have an ill-defined fatigue. Sometimes people can present with kidney problems. They can present with problems, you know, with headaches or just vague symptoms. If it's very late in the disease, very late, they develop abdominal swelling. Their eyes may turn yellow. They may get itching. And leg swelling. So that's sort of toward the end stage of the disease. So most patients don't have any symptoms until they literally fall off the cliff and start to develop severe symptoms. And once that happens, it's very advanced at that point.
So it's a long time after exposure when symptoms typically appear?
The disease has a variable course. In some people, it progresses more rapidly. I've seen people as young as in their 20s or 30s with advanced disease, or it can be a very slowly progressive disease into your 60s and even into your 70s. Now, there are certain things that will accelerate hepatitis C. For example, alcohol. We know that alcohol is like adding fuel to the fire, and particularly patients that have a long history of drinking have a very high rate of developing cirrhosis. Obesity is a massive problem now, and fatty liver also contributes to the development of cirrhosis and liver disease almost the same way that alcohol does. So that's another problem that we're facing as well, and that's causing the disease to progress more rapidly. But most patients will be asymptomatic for many years.
Well, let me ask you, is screening, you said it's not routinely done for a physical?
It is now currently recommended. The Centers for Disease Control and the American Association for the Study of Liver Disease and other organizations have come out and recommended that screening be performed universally in certain groups, as I mentioned before. And that screening, as of yet, has not really taken off. So it's an area that there needs to be education both of patients, people, and also of physicians. So there's a long way to go to get people convinced that this is an important thing to be testing for.
So would we have to go in and ask our doctor and just say we want the screening for hepatitis C?
Yeah, if you fit into one of those categories, particularly if you're born between the age of 19, 45, and 65, if you've ever used injection drugs, nasal cocaine, and the other risk factors that I mentioned, you should request a screening for hepatitis C. And that's very important.
And is the screening covered by insurance typically?
Absolutely, yes. In almost every case, screening has been covered.
Doctor, what's the rate? Is there a rate in seniors with potentially having hepatitis C? Because you seem to be really honing in on the baby boomer population.
Correct. So currently, there's a lot of epidemiological data out there that shows that about somewhere between 3 and 4 million Americans are infected with this. And just to put this in perspective, there are about 1 million people infected with HIV, or the virus that causes AIDS. So this is four times as large. And interestingly, very interestingly, the HIV-positive population is no longer dying from AIDS. Basically, that disease has been defeated for the most part. However, the HIV patients are frequently, because of the similar behaviors led to the transmission of HIV, the HIV population is now dying of hepatitis C. and it's a very alarming problem. So we're trying to resolve that.
And just out of curiosity, do you have numbers in terms of how many of those in that population, infected population, are seniors?
Oh, in terms of, the, you know, when you say you mean over the age of 65?
Right.
I don't have the precise breakdown of those numbers, but, in, you know, just in our population alone, at least 25% of our patients that we see are seniors.
Wow.
Well, doctor, let's talk about treatment. What is the current treatment for hepatitis C?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because treatment has been evolving for the past more than 20 years since I first started treating hepatitis C. And interestingly, some of the very first patients, if not the first ones ever treated, were patients that I was caring for way, way back before we knew what hepatitis C really was at that time. So treatment began by using a drug called interferon, which boosts up your own immune system. And then there was another drug added to that called ribavirin. And treatment was effective in about 15% of patients at that time. That was in the early 1990s. And treatment gradually improved to the point where we could treat about 40 to 45% of patients, but with a lot of side effects. And there were relapses and non-responders. And it's one of the reasons that screening did not become very prevalent because treatment itself was very demanding, as many of our patients can attest to. Those that were cured, and I do remind everyone that hepatitis C can be cured with therapy and was cured in many patients. However, not in everyone, and at a high cost in terms of side effects, loss of work, and actually, you know, feeling ill. Now, over the past year, the treatment has undergone what I could only call a sea change. There's been a major advances in the therapy of hepatitis C such that if this disease can be properly identified, the treatment is now going to be very safe, very effective with minimal side effects. It will be all oral, and it will be a relatively short term. And hepatitis C as a disease, as we know it, will basically cease to exist.
And, doctor, are you talking about those two new drugs that just came out?
Yes, there's two new drugs that have come out. These are the next generation direct-acting antivirals, if you will, that work directly against the virus. One is called Sovaldi, and the other is called Elicio. And these drugs are both oral, and they can be used in certain cases in combination, and they're very effective for treatment of hepatitis C. You know, in 2015, in the first part of the 2015, we anticipate further advances in treatment coming out that will be even potentially more effective, again, have very little side effects, and make this disease very, very easy to treat.
Well, Dr. Michael Epstein, gastroenterologist at Anne Arundel Medical Center, thank you so much for sharing this very important information with the two Boomer Babes.
Terrific. It's wonderful to talk to you today.
Do you ever wonder why some people spend countless hours and blood, sweat, and tears making something by hand when they can just go out and buy it at a store? Our next guest has something to say about that.
Peter Korn has been a furniture maker for the past 40 years and is the author of Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. He joins us to shoot the breeze about the value of craft in our increasingly digitalized and fast-paced world. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Peter, what's the attraction of making things by hand in our completely mass-produced world?
Well, I think people are interested in craftsmanship and practicing it themselves because there's some level of satisfaction, meaning, and fulfillment that they hope to find in that they're not finding in ordinary life.
Okay, so Peter, tell us about the process. Say you're about to make a piece of furniture and you're looking at raw planks of wood. Tell us about your creative process.
Well, for myself, and it differs from person to person, I'll start off with a design brief, which is to say I know what I'm trying to make. It could be a chair. And then I'll go through a process of sketching, which is a quick way of looking at ideas and working through them and not getting too stuck on them. And then when I find a sketch that sings to me and really appeals, I'll refine it through full-scale drawings and test it with models and mock-ups. so that by the time I invest weeks and weeks in building the finished product, I'm pretty sure it's going to work well.
But are you ever in the middle of making something you decide, hey, I'm going to go completely different way?
If I'm going to go completely different way, then something goes in the fire.
Oh. But,
I guess you're already pretty committed. But you certainly can make adjustments in the middle of a piece of furniture. You know, different art forms allow you different amounts of plasticity as you work. And with woodworking and furniture making, a lot of the creative part happens before you even pick the wood.
Peter, do you think is craft disappearing or is it really on the rebound?
I think that craft is really strong in our culture in terms of the number of people who are practicing it and drawn to it. But it's something that's disappearing in a sense off the radar as a way that you make a living or as something that's seen as an art form that has a lot of value. And I'm sorry to say that it isn't accorded much respect in that regard.
Well, I sure do enjoy though seeing all these wonderful craftspeople at the farmers markets, and you see these gorgeous, you know, jewelry, necklaces, I mean, anything, beautiful wood carvings. And just to see the workmanship that goes into it, it is really amazing.
Well, and we're in an age where more and more of our daily experience as individuals is virtual. We're dealing with our devices all day and our phones, all those things. And so the rewards of actually taking a real material like wood or clay or stone and making something, fashioning it, getting real feedback from it, and then seeing the result of what you do at the end of the day, for better or worse, that goes so deep to the human soul to have that experience.
Well, then, Peter, you say that craftsmanship is really an activity that connects us to others, but it always seemed like a rather solitary activity to me. But how does it connect you to others?
Well, there's many levels, but maybe the most obvious is through the things that you make. When the thing that you make goes out in the world and other people see it and respond to it, the thing you make is really the record of thousands of decisions that you made in the process of making it. And it somehow, hopefully, will communicate some of the questions you were asking in making it and the ideas you were exploring, even if they were subconscious ideas, and the book is partly about that. And from my point of view, for people who practice any craft, what we're really doing when we go into our workshops is saying, who am I and who can I become? Because we don't make a table or a chair or a pot because we need those things so much as because we expect to feel differently about ourselves or know more about who we can be by having gone through the creative process. So creative work, like craft, is really a process of asking who am I and who can I become. And once you've asked that, you're participating in a broad cultural conversation, even on a very quiet, reserved level.
And this will even work for those of us that have absolutely no artistic talent
and can't hold a hammer or a saw.
You betcha. We have students come through our Center for Furniture Craftsmanship at all levels of experience, and every one of them leaves better able to make things than when they arrived, even though we all have differing amounts of native talent.
Well, the bar might be set really low for
it
me
might
and Kathy.
Be.
Well, I invite you to come find out.
Okay, we'd love to. You might
we
be very frustrated. Well, Peter Korn, furniture maker and author of Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the babes.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.